This is Wilderness and Wildlife, presented by the Gallatin Wildlife Association in Bozeman, Montana. This is a half-hour program featuring interviews and commentaries relating to unique natural environment that we enjoy in the greater Yellowstone ecosystem and even throughout the United States and around the world. I'm your host, Jay Schell. Our interview today is with Rob Amen, who retired from the Western Transportation Institute at Montana State University. He's now working half-time at the Center for Large Landscapes Conservation here in Bozeman. Almost all of his work on crossings these days is international. He is linear infrastructure ecologist for the U.S. Aid Project for Asia. And he's the linear infrastructure ecologist on roadways, power lines, railways for a four-year U.S. Aid Project for Asia, a joint project with the World Wildlife Fund. For the International Union for the Conservation of Nature, which is known as IUCN, he's co-chair of their Transportation Working Group, and they're about to publish the Handbook for Mitigation of Roads and Railways in Asian Elephant Land. So that's quite an introduction. Rob, thanks very much for talking with us today. It's good to be with you.
Thank you, John.
So what does that mean, you're a linear infrastructure ecologist?
Well, I started out my career primarily addressing roads here in the U.S. Northern Rockies. But as we see, it's not just roads that are fragmenting our landscapes. We also have rails. Often our railways are right adjacent to our highways. So you might want to treat the highway and then often with a crossing, and then the animals still have to get across the railroad. And also, there's issues with canals, there's issues with pipelines, power lines, all kinds of linear infrastructure. But I focus mostly on transport infrastructure, roads and rails, although power lines has been included in my most recent USAID project in Asia.
So, and you've been working in Asia for the most part since we last talked.
That's correct. The current project I'm working on, it's called the LINE, Asian Linear Infrastructure Safeguards, is a four-year project, a little over $6 million, and it's my third USAID project based in Asia.
Does that require you making several trips to Asia over the course of a year?
Yes, I've been in many different countries. The current project is focusing on India, Nepal, and Mongolia, and I've been to all three countries. But we're in charge of also building capacity across the region, so we'll do workshops. I've done workshops in Malaysia, on Borneo, the Malaysia portion of the island of Borneo. I just gave two lectures to graduate engineering students at the University of Beijing. So I try to get around the region, not just in those three countries.
So this is a joint project of the Center for Large Landscapes Conservation in Bozeman and the World Wildlife Fund.
Yes, WWF, as it's called shorthand, is has offices in India, Nepal, and Mongolia. So they're really the on-the-ground group, and my organization, the Center, or CLLC for short, provides mostly the capacity building and the technical support for the project.
And you're also engaged with the International Union for the Conservation of Nature. What's that?
Yeah, so the Center for Large Landscape Conservation provides the secretariat for a specialist group for the IUCN. Primarily, it's all volunteer experts from around the world that join. This one happens to be focused on, it's called the Connectivity Conservation Specialist Group. So we look at large landscapes and ecological connectivity and the notion of providing ecological networks, not just protected areas. We know protected and connected is better than just protected. So the specialist group has over 1,000 members on all the continents. So it's well represented. And within that, again, because it's about connectivity and linear infrastructure creates such a barrier for wildlife movement, they formed a transport working group for which I co-chair. And we have two subgroups of that because trying to do the whole world is pretty difficult. So we're experimenting with an Asian elephant transport working group, which I co-chair. Mm. And then there's a Latin America Caribbean transport working group, primarily Spanish and Portuguese speaking countries. And they're focusing in their region. So we have a regional group and a species focused group, all trying to address the transport, roads and rails and canals.
So there is overlap between the USAID project and the IUCN project?
Yeah. So again, with IUCN, we primarily volunteer our expertise. And so the expertise I gained through my USAID projects is being applied to the IUCN. As you mentioned in the lead up, we just published another report for the IUCN in July, and that is how to address ecological connectivity when developing roads, rails, and canals. That's an international focus report, a technical report for the IUCN. The other one we're about to publish in the next 1 to 2 months is a handbook, actually, for Asian elephant to reduce the impacts of roads and railways on Asian elephants. And so much of the solution for most of these includes wildlife crossings, which gets back to the subject we first talked about many years ago.
Is the IUCN related to the United Nations at all?
No, it's its own organization. Uh-huh. And over 180 governments do belong to it, government agencies from 180 countries. And I think there's quite a few nonprofit, NGO, non-governmental organizations, conservation groups, also, and academic associations. So it's basically experts covering everything from, its real focus is protecting biodiversity and trying to stop the extinction of species. So just like we have the Endangered Species Act in the U.S., the IUCN is the international body for the Red List, which highlights the threatened and endangered species from all over the world.
And I gather it's been around for quite a long time.
Yeah, I think about 70 years now. They said it would never be formed today. It's quite unusual for so many governments to work with NGOs in the same organization.
Are highway collisions and rail collisions a serious problem in Southeast Asia?
Yes, throughout the world. And what's happening is because economic development in developing countries is often rooted in having better transportation systems, we're seeing a rapid expansion of roads, rails, and power lines all over developing countries, not only in Asia, but Africa and Latin America as well. So we're hoping many of the lessons we learned in North America and Europe and Australia is now being applied in other parts of the world. So what I feel I'm doing at the end of my career is transferring a lot of the technical knowledge I gained here in North America, here in the Greater Yellowstone too, and taking it and working with others on different species. So we might be focusing on moose and they might be focusing on elephants, but the solution of crossings with fencing that guides the animals safely either under or over the road, separates them from traffic, is the same solution over and over again on all the continents, basically.
So there aren't any elephants in Mongolia, are there?
No, they are in Nepal and India.
So what other species besides elephants do you have major concern about with highway and rail collisions?
Well, again, like Mongolia, again, it's just starting to develop its highway system, and it only had one railway between Beijing and its capital, Ulaanbaatar. And now they're developing a whole series of new railways to connect the mines, and they export the ore primarily to China to refine the ore there, the smelters. So a lot of new railways are going into, say, the Gobi Desert area of Mongolia. And they have primarily ungulates, so it's very similar to, say, our eastern grasslands here in Montana. Uh-huh. So they have a lot of antelope species, and they have bighorn sheep, Argali sheep. And so it's not unlike habitats here with just different types of ungulates. And so they're really trying to address these new rails, especially. What's very different in Mongolia rails than, say, here in North America, they have continuous fencing. And so basically they have fragmented, cut many of these populations of antelopes. Saiga antelope would be one example.
Interrupting their migration routes, I gather.
Absolutely. They can't move. And what's very different in the Gobi is they don't have annual migrations like we do here because between winter and summer range. Their animals have to follow the rain. They literally, wherever there's green up and it's occurring randomly across the desert, they sense it and they move towards it. And so they have episodic or sporadic migration versus our annual type of migration. So it's a different type of system. But again, the solutions are harder there because you can't say, oh, they keep coming here all the time and cross the road at this exact spot. Same with the railway. So what they've done is they fenced the railways because of it's primarily a nomadic herder of domestic animals in that area. Everything from domestic camels to sheep. And so they want it fenced so that the trains don't run over their domestic critters, but it's horrible for the wildlife. So we're hoping to work with the Mongolian government under this USA project to help develop a more sensible, creating gaps in the fence or a no-fence area in key wildlife locations.
Going back to the highways, do they fence the highways as well?
No, they don't. They don't have many highways. The Gobi, I was there 10 years ago on a project from a copper mine, and it was going to be the first paved road in the entire Gobi Desert. And it was basically a haul road for the trucks to carry the ore to the Chinese border because they didn't have a rail system built. So it was a short-term solution, and it was going to be the first paved road. So we made recommendations for wildlife crossings, but they didn't build them, unfortunately. So we have no evidence yet of using those kinds of structures to reduce roadkill. They were going to wait until if the roadkill hit a certain mortality level, that would then cause them to spend the money to build the crossings. And they haven't seen that much mortality because of that single road.
Are those highways high-speed highways?
Well, as you can imagine, an ore truck is quite big and heavy, but they don't go very fast. You know, but other parts of Asia are, you know, no different than here with their highways. They're four-lane, controlled access, high-speed, high-volume, and they're expanding that whole system. They have an Asian highway system, and they want to have a four-lane, you know, equivalent to, say, our interstate highways, all the way from Bangkok to Europe, all the way through Asia. They have Asia Highway 1, they have Asia Highway 2. It has different highway numbers in each country, but basically they're stitching together these four-lane highway systems, north and south, east and west, you know, for economic and social development purposes. And that's where we really want to focus a lot of our attention. A good example, in Nepal, they only have two-lane highways, but they have a highway that goes all the way across the entire country from east to west below the Himalaya Mountains and in the plains below the Himalayas.
Mm-hmm.
And they're turning it from a two-lane into a four-lane expressway. So suddenly, you know, sort of slow local traffic kind of situation to an international highway that's going to go faster with more vehicles. You can imagine, and it's adjacent to all their national parks. So we're paying attention and working with them to make sure that the mitigation is proper. They may build their first wildlife overpass on the first segment of highway they're building right now outside Chitwan National Park. So that would be a first. They do have a whole series of underpasses being scheduled to be built on the first road segment.
Are collisions the major problem, or is fragmentation the greater problem?
Yeah, that's a great question, because how do we know if the traffic levels are high enough where it's creating a barrier or at least a partial filter for wildlife movement, or if it's actually doesn't dissuade them from trying to cross the road, and when they do, they get killed. So that's always a dilemma to sort those two, which is worse, the mortality or the barrier mm-hmm. effect. And the beautiful thing about crossings with fencing that directs the animals to the crossings is that they take care of both situations, and they cover both large and small animals. So you might be focused on, say, tigers in Chitwin National Park and building a crossing for them uh-huh. to make them safe. But because you build those crossings, all the other species, if you design them properly, most all will use them as uh-huh. well. So you reconnect landscapes and you reduce direct mortality due to roadkill.
Do any of those countries keep statistics on mortalities?
No, not that I know of, that they have a standard data collection system. Uh-huh. I mean, gosh, even the U.S. doesn't have that, right? We we have sort of different states do different things.
Right,
so,
right.
Of course, the new infrastructure bill here in the United States has the Secretary of Transportation has to develop national standards for wildlife vehicle collision data, but they're voluntary. But at least we'll have something to shoot for across all 50 states. That same situation occurs all across the world. There's a few European countries that have standard collection. I know like the Czech Republic does. Uh-huh. But in Asia, it's not standardized in any country I've worked in so far.
Are China or India engaged in efforts to prevent collisions?
Yes. You'd be surprised what India is doing. The last time I was in India, our field trip was to a project near, it's called Rajiji National Park, and the buffer zone outside has tigers, has elephants, has gar, which is the largest bovine or cow species in Asia, and they also have bison, and so water buffalo. So mm-hmm. They're lifting the highway for 12 kilometers. So what is that times about 7 miles? And so it'll be 6 to 10 meters off the ground, and all animals and all processes, you know, ecological processes, pretty much will go unhindered for the entire stretch. There's another project that I've also been involved with. We developed a roadkill data collector at the Western Transportation Institute and mm-hmm. for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and for National Park Service. And they allowed us to take it to India and set up a local NGO on this highway outside Kasaranga National Park. This is also has, you know, elephants and rhinoceri and tigers and all the other species. And it's a 50-kilometer segment of a two-lane highway all along the park boundary that's going to be transformed into four lanes, and it'll be part of this Asian highway system. So it's going from a national highway to an international expressway. So, you know, their project engineer has decided it's so expensive to try to bury the highway so that animals can move safely in and out of the park that he wants to lift it also. In other words, 6 to 8 meters above the ground, just have a what they call flyovers. He wants to do it for 35 kilometers of that 50-kilometer section. So what is that? Over 32 miles. But a 32-mile section of highway, trying to do a quick calculation here, and 35 of that, about over 20 miles, will be lifted up into the air just so that animals can safely move in and out of the park.
So have techniques for crossings, are they different in Asia? Is there anything that you've learned or been able to accomplish in Asia that differs from what's being done in the U.S.?
Actually, there hasn't been any move to develop new materials like low-carbon materials. Right now, it's still cement and steel, standard engineering applications. They have these machines for elevated highways that just, they look like, I call them big praying mantises, if you can imagine that as a machine that pours concrete above the ground. Mm. But basically, it's standard materials and techniques they use for urban highways when they lift one in a city. So, no, they haven't. But we tried to work and develop a new material called fiber-reinforced connection with glass strands. And the nice thing about this system is it's low carbon. Eventually, they're trying to use recycled plastic as the base material for it. And it's light, so it's very highly mobile. And you can, in Europe, they've built several wildlife crossings, one over a highway, one over a canal that I've seen. I actually visited the one over the highway, and they put it in 6 hours, and they just put it on the back of a semi-trailer and bring it to the highway position. So if we all recall the bridge they tried, North 7th Bridge they built over Interstate 90 outside of Bozeman, it took them about a year, and this goes in 6 hours. So very modular too, so you can move them up and down. Say if with climate change, we don't know what shifts are going to be occurring with animal occupation and use of our landscape. So the nice thing about the FRP is you could potentially pull it up and move it in the future, because most crossings are built for 75 years. So I hope if we want to help animals adapt, I think the future is to make these structures modular, and thus you can't make them out of steel and concrete.
Between the different countries you're working in, do they approach solutions in different ways? And are some countries more active than others?
Yes, I would say India is becoming a real leader. Nepal is, because they don't have any, super railroads and super highways, and they're starting to build their power infrastructure, their grid, as it were. They're very interested in being as green as they can. So some of the kind of Malaysia is very progressive too. And so it depends on the country. Other countries have to worry. I mean, they're very poor countries, and they can barely afford some of this new infrastructure, let alone the additional costs of say an overpass. So sometimes they're saying, because a lot of this is funded by multilateral development banks, not by their own taxpayers. In other words, they get loans from foreign banks, basically. Easy to get a loan, but hard to pay it back, right?
Yeah, right.
So they do have to be very cautious about how they spend things and what the budgets for this new infrastructure is. But when you think of what India is doing, like 35 miles of a highway, and we argue about whether it should be 50-meter overpass or 60-meter overpass, and they go 30 miles, it tells you that it's all about social will. It's if the taxpayers say we want to protect our wildlife, then we make sure that that cost is incorporated into the designs of our roads and rails.
So are there some resistance interests that are trying to stop this kind of activity?
Yeah, I would say some of the project engineers at that level, just when they get the price tag for some of the mitigation, one of the, this is just a story that I heard repeated, but one of the Nepal highway projects, the engineer said something along the lines that, it's the foreigners that are driving the cost up because they want to come view our wildlife. so you can, because tourists do come to Chitwan National Park to see tigers and elephants, and rhinos. So, I mean, there's a lot of truth to what he said, but also it's sort of that old school, we just want to do it the way we always do it and don't want to add any new wrinkles that we're unfamiliar with, such as designing it for wildlife.
Right.
But the good news is they're building a whole bunch on that segment. They are indeed building like 20 or 30 wildlife underpasses. So they are investing, and we learned it here in the U.S. I take pictures of the radio collars in Wyoming on Interstate 80, or five different ungulate species with radio collars. There's only one crossing, right? All the animals come up to I-80 and stop, at least the collared animals. And it was like moose and deer, mule deer and elk, and I forget what the two other species, antelope, pronghorn. So, we learned our lessons here, and now we're retrofitting I-80. There's crossings that have gone in Nevada, gone into Utah, are going to go into Wyoming.
Right.
Because we built our highway not considering the wildlife.
So are you optimistic about the future in these Asian countries where you've been working?
Yeah, especially in the tropics, because it's so rich in biodiversity.
Uh-huh.
And we can never study all those animals, you know, in the next 10 years to know which ones are sensitive to traffic. You know, is it the barrier effect? Is it the mortality? How are local populations being affected? But we do know if we make our roads permeable for them, then there's much less concern about the impact of supersizing our roads and railways.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I wanted to I did ask you about China. Is China responsive to you now?
Well, China's an interesting case because they have, I don't know if your audience knows about the Belt and Road Initiative launched by, you know, the
right,
Premier
right.
Xi back in, what was it, 2013, 2014. But it was their sort of foreign, it was basically to co-develop and have access to markets, not only in Asia, but in Africa as well. And they even considered South America, where China investments in linear infrastructure, roads, rails, and ports, they also have a maritime component to the Belt and Road Initiative. But bottom line is they give the loans for these, but they have no environmental requirements.
Uh-huh. Okay.
So if you're a poor country, you don't have to do anything to protect biodiversity, and you may not want to invest, even though it might be in, you know, your citizens' self-interest to protect your wildlife. But they don't have to. Where most of the Western lenders, like, you know, say the Asian Development Bank or the World Bank, they do have environmental safeguard requirements. They call it ENS standards, ecological and social standards for development. So I would say within China, they're doing a good job. The Chinese are, I've been in Yunnan province, one of their richest areas for biodiversity in southwest China, where they have built all kinds of crossings for wildlife. But when that funding goes across the border, then there's no requirement. So I think the world is pushing back on that and trying to get China to be more, have some more strings attached to their loans so that biodiversity is protected.
Well, Rob, we've run out of time, but I really appreciate it. It's been fascinating to talk with you about what's going on in Asia. So thanks an awful lot.
Yeah, thank you. And really, what we've learned is being applied all over the world. So we want to keep experimenting here with different species and new techniques. It could easily be adapted on a global basis.
Right. So, our guest today has been Rob Amon, who works for the Center for Large Landscapes Conservation in Bozeman. He's a linear infrastructure ecologist for the USAID program in Asia. So this has been Wilderness and Wildlife, presented by the Gallatin Wildlife Association in Bozeman, Montana. To hear more of these half-hour interviews, go online to kgvm.org and listen to our features of our website. Thanks very much for listening. I'm your host, Jay Shell.